Yes, sir, it's your boy, Big Vern. You're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM and WGXC.org. You heard?
I'm Cheryl Kay, host of The Jazz Disturbance, the show that started with WGXC in 2011. During our Tower Power Fall 2022 pledge drive, I'm asking for your support, and I'm asking for several reasons. One reason, we need more of you to become monthly sustaining donors, like me. We need an additional $1,250 a month, making our monthly revenue over $4,000. Another reason, our tower lease will soon expire, and we need the funds to renew it. Yet another reason is one we're all familiar with, ongoing expenses like electricity, the phone bill, etc. Your pledge of support helps with all of that. Shows like The Jazz Disturbance and Situation Fluxus, the other show that I host on Thursdays, have a home on the FM dial. Make your pledge of support at wgxc.org/donate or call area code 518-697-7400. That's wgxc.org/donate or 518-697-7400. Thank you. WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Alexander Adam of Athens, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
Take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening. Kevin Factor here, and this is Foraging Ahead. I am so excited to share with you my conversation with Sean Cullen. Sean is an actor, a singer, a songwriter, a remarkable human being, and he shared some fabulous stories of his decades in theater with me, and I'm going to share them with you. And I also cut in a bunch of his songs. Sean, he's appeared in Tony Gilroy's Oscar-nominated Michael Clayton with George Clooney, whoever that is. He was in Lincoln Center's Tony Award-winning Rodgers and Hammerstein. And he just completed principal photography for She Said, starring Carrie Mulligan, and the independent Bunker. He's just a remarkable guy and a warm, generous person. And we talked for, hours. And we ranged all over, as is often the case in Foraging Ahead. Four parts conversation. Start with Al Pacino, meeting and working with Al Pacino in his first performance with Al Pacino, and then later another.
So there's this great story that you tell about the.
Sorry about that. I'm just gonna roll this. Sean Cullen, many facets of a gem of a human being. I'm going to start with Al Pacino.
First time you worked with Al Pacino. Would you mind sharing that with us?
Sure. I was in Los Angeles doing a play. I was understudying a play at the Center Theater Group at the Amundsen, James Joyce of the Dead, and I had understudied Christopher Walken and Steven Spinella in the Broadway version, and they brought me out very kindly. Richard Nelson, who was up there, Rhinebeck over there in Rhinebeck, he brought me out from New York to understudy, and there's a guy I catered with named Tim. Tim and I had, you know, been kind of struggling and working together, Tim found out that I was going to go to Los Angeles and that my agent, I didn't say this to you before, but my agent said that if I went out there and made like, you know, $1,500 a week, would they send me out the office in LA, send me out for film and television? And she said, no.
No.
Yeah, man. I think back on it, man. There's a story similar about more than half of what I've done. So not dissimilar to that, the effect. I said, fax me the deal memo. We were faxing, man. Fax me the deal memo, I said so bravely. And I turned to the wind. No. She faxed me the deal memo. I said, I'll just negotiate this myself. And thanks so much. I really like you. But, you know, I don't believe that actors have the power to fire agents. They say it all the time. But, I mean, the net effect is they've ended the relationship. But I did not fire her. But I just said, I'm just going to negotiate this myself. And we're done. So I threw caution in the wind because now I didn't have an agent. I told Tim this at a catering job, and he said, you know, I want to get into management. It's not funny. He said, I'm going to, would you be interested if I made phone calls for you while you're out there hook you up meeting cast directors? I said, sure, what did I have to lose? Lo and behold, I had done this Law & Order SVU episode, and two really good scenes where I played the serial killer. At the time, I thought it was, you know, like the greatest American television acting at the time. And now I see that it really is way over the top. But that aside, I said, okay, well, let me just get 40, 50 VHS copies of this. I'll edit it together. And this will be the only thing that I will be bringing out to Los Angeles with my resume. And there I go to do the show and understudy, and Tim starts calling around, and like within maybe 3 or 4 weeks, I have 40 casting directors that Tim has called. God love him, from Manhattan Beach, on the coast there, on the shore, in Los Angeles in the south, up to the San Fernando Valley. I get my little rental cart. The theater gave me a rental car, Kevin. Do you know how rare that is for a theater to give each actor a rental car for free? And I throw 40 packets of United States priority envelopes with apologies to the Postmaster General. I make individual packets with little notes, picture and resume, and this videotape in each one of these 40 envelopes. I put them back in the back of the car. By the way, I have my Thomas guide, which we've talked about before. So I have – this is before the internet, or at least for me it was before the internet. I put these envelopes in the order in which they will be dropped off from Manhattan Beach. I figured out, you know, so I don't drive up and down all over. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I drop off one of them, goes to Francine Mazler's office at the old MGM studios, a Sony in Culver City. And I don't know who she is at that point. She's just a name and an address and a dear Francine on my little note. And 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, whenever, Tim calls me and he says, hey, I got an audition for you. There was only one audition he got me, by the way.
Out of 40?
Out of 40. And it was for this movie. And I went in and I auditioned. I put myself, you know, there was a tape, a video camera there. Francine was not there. Her assistant put me on tape. I've never met Francine, and now she's cast me in two big movies. And I did this thing, as we talked about. I had the Thomas guide with me. I'd made a choice. I was living in Silver Lake with my friend Joseph at the time. At his place there, Angelina Heights and ish, and I'd rehearsed the thing, walked with the sides, I printed them out. That's how I memorize lines and work on parts. I just take walks with them. I brought the Thomas guide, I decided, and I also brought my yawn. I had decided during one of the circuits around Silver Lake that my character was going to yawn in the scene. So I did it. And 2 weeks later, everything happened in 2 or 3 weeks, I guess. Tim calls me from New York and he says, Sean, I'm calling because you booked this movie. I said, he said, yeah. Francine Mazur's office called, and you're going to play the lawyer in this new Al Pacino movie called Simone. I was like, oh my God. I didn't know any of that. I just parted company with my agent. I'm here understudying, and now I have two scenes with Al Pacino in this movie. The play closes in Los Angeles. I fly to New York. I'm there for like a week. I fly back to Los Angeles because I have to shoot. I have one day, two scenes with Al Pacino, and I'm flying out once I get there the next night, like at the end of the night shooting with Pacino. I'm flying on the midnight flight to Washington because The Dead is going to the Kennedy Center for 6 weeks, and I'm actually playing a part there. I'm not understudying the same play, James Joyce of The Dead. I get to the studio. I see one of the first people I meet is a woman named Rita, who had done the hair and makeup for Lend Me a Tenor at the Vineyard Playhouse in Vineyard Haven in the summer of 1991. Now it's the summer of 2000. And I'm so surprised and so happy to see her. She was always lovely. I didn't have a wig, so she didn't deal with me in the Vineyard. But I walk in. Andrew Niccol was the director. I think he wrote it as well. Very lovely guy from New Zealand or Australia. I think he's New Zealand. And he's like, hello, Sean. So glad to see you. And this is going to be so sensational. Al's just in here. Oh, you look fine. You look very well. Come to sit. Al's just over here. Al. Pacino comes over. And he looks at me. I can't remember. You know, it was 20 years ago. But he didn't shake my hand because he had the flu or he had a cold, really bad cold. Oh, and this would be good because I'll tell you about Paterno when I saw him 20 years later, which I didn't say before. So anyway, so I shake his hand, and Andrew could not be more effervescent. He's just the picture of a bubbling, movie comedy director, and with his script, and we do it the one time, and I had yawned as I had in Culver City. A month before in the scene, we get to the end. Pause. Pacino looks at me and then he looks at Andrew and he says, is he going to yawn like that? So I was downcast. I don't mind admitting it. I was like, whoa, what the heck, man? Sure. This is not like I pictured it was going to go when I flew out here yesterday. And so now I go, it's lunch, immediately after that. Is he going to yawn like that? And Andrew says whatever Andrew says. And then literally somebody said, okay, lunch, we're back in an hour. And I go to the cafeteria, the canteen, whatever, the commissary at this particular studio, and by myself. I remember I was careful not to drink any kind of caffeinated lunch beverage, as we've talked about Coke and Pepsi, because I didn't want to be under the influence of anything. And there was this really funny. I am just about as glum as I can be in such a situation. And there's this Asian American fellow in a leather jumpsuit, white. I think he might have had a scarf around his neck, sunglasses. His hair was teased, coiffed. He's an Elvis Presley impersonator, and he's singing karaoke in the dining room there, the studio. Very surreal that was. And I go back to hair and makeup. I get put my suit on because this time we're going to do it for real. And I'm like, well, I've decided I'm definitely not going to yawn.
Must have been the most excruciating lunch. Knowing that this performer, this Elvis impersonator, is like seared into your memory because you were just.
Oh yeah, the detail really, of that. In hindsight, it's a good part of the story, but I just thought, man, I'm feeling weird. This is weird.
So you get back to the thing, you decide not to yawn.
I decide not to yawn, and we sit across the table from each other, and you know, there's a, I can't even remember if this started out like this. Maybe we even, one of us even asked for a newspaper. Thank you. One of us even asked for a newspaper as we started doing it. But so that's how we began to actually film, to work and film the scene that we'd done just one time at the table. And lo and behold, Pacino, somewhere between 20, 24, three dozen takes, two cameras behind me on him, and he just seemed to be having, it just it was no specific moment that I can remember, he just seemed like he began to have the time of his life over there. And we just did the scene again and again, and we were doing it not because he thought any of them were necessarily bad. He just wanted to see. I mean, I haven't asked him about this, but he was having a great time. He started, whether he had the flu or what, you know, just a cold, or it was all aside, and he was engaged, and he, as we've talked about, was in a little bit of ecstasy, and in terms of creativity, he wanted to see what was going to happen next. We started improvising. The newspaper showed up on some point on the table, and I was showing him what the press had reported in this movie about him, the movie director, who had pretended that this, who had committed fraud essentially, and saying that this movie actress in his new movie was a human being when actually she's computer generated. And P.S., he, Pacino's character, has fallen in love with her. Did I mention that? So, he's under arrest, and I'm his lawyer, and I'm like, dude, you got a cop to this, man. Look at the LA Times or whatever it was. And we just had a great time. And to the point where when they finally came around back on me, with two cameras, you know, I got like a dozen whacks at it myself. Wasn't the situation where we filmed both of us at the same time with two cameras, one camera on, you know, me and the other on Pacino. We did it that way. And he was very generous when the cameras came around too, and on me. And from that terror that I described, you know, being in lunch moments ago, we're waiting to set up the second scene. And I remember standing up against a wall at the soundstage and talking to Rita, and Rita says to me, you know, we're just talking about nothing. And at a quiet moment, she says, "Sean, have you and Al ever worked together before?" And I said, that we hadn't, because we hadn't, I just met him that afternoon. But the journey that was taken there in just those several hours of, here's Rita, who I knew from the Vineyard from 9 years before, and feeling like, what are they going to do? Am I going to get back on that plane and not shoot this? I mean, wow, I've really stepped in it, haven't I? And feeling that terror, and that like I'd done something wrong, and I'm isolated, and all those other feelings that can come up, at least for me, in situations like that, to Rita asking me if I'd ever worked with him before, because she said was enjoying it so much and we worked together so well, was, you know, something that I have never forgotten and never will, you know, and it's all, you know, and it's a little bit sweeter because Al Pacino's involved, right?
Do you think perhaps he said that about the yawn to intentionally freak you out? So maybe so you would approach the scene with a little bit of terror or fear or somewhat destabilized? Or do you think he was just kind of crabby. He had a cold and.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen him in movies, and he is and certainly can be a genius, you know. Is he playing that kind of three-dimensional chess in that moment with me? I don't think so. I think he's just like a guy with the flu, and he's like, how many of these player actors often do I have to deal with? And now he's yawning. Can we just go to the trailer? Is it launched yet? You know, kind of thing. Honestly. And then, So, yeah. But the day progressed to such a point where we did two scenes all together, and the next scene we're in a different holding area, and Andrew had blocked it in such a way that I was sitting on a table, you know, my butt up there on a table, and Pacino was sitting down in a chair below me, and we were talking about the scene, and I wasn't saying a damn thing. You know, I'm not going to tempt fate, regardless of what Rita just said to me. And I said at the end of it, I said, do you mind if I make a suggestion? And Andrew looked at me and said, you know, sure, you know. And Pacino probably just looked at me, and I said, I think I'd like to try me sitting in the chair and Al sitting on the table with me below him, looking up at him and trying to convince him of what I'm trying to convince him of in the scene. And there was a pause, and Andrew was, I don't know if he literally hemmed and hawed or if he said, but Pacino had thought about it, and he said, yeah, let's do what he said. Let's try it at least. And lo and behold, we did it that way. And again, just part of the journey of that day, you know. And the scenes turned out really well. And that's
the cut that made
maybe
it into
we did
the
it
film.
Two or three times, and he gets up off the table, and he starts to walk past me, which really worked really well, and the camera's moving. And sometimes I'm pretty smart myself, and sometimes I'm just talking way too much, as we've talked about. But the way I presented my suggestion was part of it. You know, it's always part of how you say something and all that stuff, right? But it's so in this we didn't talk about before, but so now it's August of whatever, like 5 years ago, 4 years ago. And speaking of Yonkers, because we had talked about Yonkers, we are at an old warehouse facility or factory facility very close to the shores of the Hudson there on the eastern side of the Hudson at a makeshift sound studio shooting Paterno for HBO. And there's Barry Levinson. So
you're in Paterno.
So I walk in, and I know Pacino is because I see the New York Post occasionally just to check the sports pages. And I had seen a picture of Pacino in character as Paterno. And oh my God, I'm working with Al Pacino again. And the woman who cast me in Michael Clayton, Ellen Chenoweth, has cast me. And oh my God, there's Annie Paris, who played my daughter in this production of The Wild Duck that got me on Broadway. And she's playing Pacino's daughter, and she's sitting right next to me. And I love her, and I really love her brother, Louis Conchelmi, who I've done play with in Williamstown. And so it's kind of like a little bit of old home week. But then meeting Barry Levinson, of course, was a thing, you know. Hi, Barry. You know, I'm not calling him Mr. Levinson at that point. I don't do that anymore. But, you know, but I'm in Barry Levinson's company, and he's cast me, and boy, it's pretty good here. I lost a little bit of weight. My suit's feeling real. My clothes are feeling good. Got a little bit of coffee. Wow. And here comes Al Pacino up to me. And I said, Barry brought him over across the big dining room table in the scene. And I said, hi, Al, I'm Sean Cullen. I don't know if you remember me. But he said, no, of course I remember you. Those scenes, he said, those scenes. I said, I forget everybody else, but actors I remember. Those scenes were good, right? And we start nice. Playing the scenes, right?
Nice.
And I remember working with Pacino 20 years ago. And
right.
He starts playing. Now there's a couple different, few different cameras, and you know, so you don't have to turn around and do all that stuff. And I start playing. And some of it's too much, you know? And definitely got Barry Levinson's attention. Mm-hmm. But Pacino and I are, because there's a table full of his family and advisors, and I've been hired by Penn State to come and get him to, I think it was Penn State. In real life, this guy from Washington, it was definitely Penn State, but yeah. I can't remember who brought my character into Pacino's, into Paterno's dining room. And we started playing again, man. There's no newspaper. And then Pacino told the story about he started talking between takes. We were sitting at a dining room table with these really good actors. And there's Al Pacino about 6 feet away from me sitting at a table. And now Al Pacino is telling a story about David Mamet play that he did on Broadway and how he discovered something in doing the David Mamet play about acting. About acting.
Huh. What was it?
I'll tell you later. That's what we all wanted to know. He said he couldn't tell us right then. Right? Yeah, exactly. That's what people around the table want, you know? I mean, he's just an actor talking, but again, there's a little bit of salt and pepper and a little sweetness because it's Al Pacino, right? And we've all seen him. And we do the scene. There's more direction from Barry Levinson, who was really very fine to work with, very fine. Then we did another scene, Pacino and I, and was it one of the guys who played his son? I can't remember. I compose his letter of resignation on the computer, or he dictates it to me. I can't remember. I'm at the keyboard. I remember. But at a certain point, he said, I'll tell you later. And he was talking specifically to me, right? So, and then the day went by, you know, and it all went really fine. It all went really, really fine. Eventually, you know, it all went really fine. And Barry Levinson was very pleased, and it was fun to see Annie, and the whole experience was so nice. So nice, Kevin.
Clover, silly apple tree, set on the beach, pitching peach pits in the sea. Talk a bit of this and a smoke a bit of that, grinning in the shade of two old straw hats. Suey says, hey sister, whatever happened to that one? She got married down in Michigan to a Senator Smith's son. Suey clucks his tongue, says, I'd like to have been there. Sure love the way she wore that lightning in her hair. Sister Clover, silly apple tree, sit on the beach, pitch pits in the sea. Top a bit of this and the smoke a bit of that, grinning in the shade of two old straw hats. I don't want to be a great mind. I don't want to change the world. I just want to change the mind of one pretty blue-eyed, true-eyed girl. Sister say, Suey, now I remember there's that one. Settle down up in Ohio, here she's having her second son. Suey grunts, uh-huh, yeah, that's no big surprise. Sure miss the seven sisters and slept beneath her starry eyes. Sister Clover, Suey, apple tree, sit on the beach, pitching peach pits in the sea. Talk a bit of this and the smoke a bit of that, grinning in the shade of two old straw hats. I don't miss the broken china. I don't miss the long train rides. I just miss the peals of laughter that raised my heart and split my sides. Sister say, hey, Suey, I got here the ultimate question. Of all of them that got away, was there one extra special one? Suey holds his breath, seems a whole hour passes as the movie of his one true love plays behind his pink Polaroid sunglasses. Sister Clover, Suey, apple tree, sit on the beach, pitching peach pits in the sea. Talk a bit of this and the smoke a bit of that, in the shade of two old straw hat.
You're listening to Foraging Ahead, and my interview with Sean Cullen, an actor of screen, theater, television. Next up, a little more Al Pacino.
But anyway, so I went on to Pacino's door. I never, like I said, I don't usually do this. This is like four or five years ago. And the door opens. I said, Al, I just want to say thanks, man. It was really great, whatever. And he said, oh, no, don't go anywhere. Wait, I just got to put my whatever on, right? And a sweatshirt or whatever. And he said, I want to tell you that story. He said that he started in the thing, right?
Oh.
And he told me the story. I'll tell you off the record about what it was, but it's interesting. And I was a little surprised, I have to tell you, just about lines and spontaneity and all this stuff, you know, and an older actor on stage. We'll just leave it at that. It was just that mysterious. I know. I'll tell you. And if people really want to know, they'll just have to call out.
Yeah. No, I totally get it.
Yeah.
That's between you.
Yeah. And even if it was you in that trailer, I wouldn't want to tell the story without you, especially the sensitivity of it. He's just wonderful. So we walk from his trailer now to the soundstage door, and we're walking and talking, and we're walking and he's doing all the talking and I'm listening and going, oh, wow, no, you know, and asking him questions. And we get to the door, and he finishes the story, and I said, wow. He said, listen, he said, I'm doing this movie with Scorsese, wants me to do it, and, you know, I guess I'm going to do it. I'm not trying not to work that. But he said, there's parts in it for you. He said, so call your agent and tell them that, you know, that we talked and see if you get me on, you know. And I knew the casting director. It wasn't the same casting director. And that's the last time I saw Al Pacino, was him telling me about The Irishman that Scorsese was directing with De Niro and him and all that cast. And that was the last I saw. So can you imagine, though, it's a nice little fairy tale ending to is he going to yawn like this to there's a Scorsese movie, call your agent, get him to Well, this is the business in a nutshell. I go to my car because that's where I was going initially, right? Go home. And I call my agent and I say, listen, did I write to her first? I think I wrote to her directly, the casting director. And then I called my agent like about 20 minutes later. I had her email too, because she's cast me in a movie, Revolutionary Road, what's his name? You know, Kate Winslet, and who plays her husband in Revolutionary Road, most famous actor in the world. She cast me in the Revolutionary Road. Scenes that were cut out, but they made it to deleted scenes on the DVD. I'm going to think of the actor's name. But anyway, so I had her email address, and I'd written to her, and I said, hi, you know, Alice in Wonderland, that's not her name. I hope you're well. I just finished shooting a couple scenes with Al Pacino and Paterno here this afternoon up in Yonkers, and he told me about a film that you're casting that Martin Scorsese's directing. Martin Scorsese, by the way, had me on hold to be one of the leads in Boardwalk Empire. I was supposed to go to his townhouse over one weekend, and I never – that was the end of it. I never went to his place. Million stories, right? Wow. And then I call my agent like maybe a half hour later on the way back up here from Yonkers, and my agent told me that Ellen had gotten in touch with them, Alice in Wonderland had gotten in touch with them and said, please tell Sean not to email me anymore about this kind of thing. Pacino does this all the time, and it's really annoying. Dude.
Oh.
I got a million of them.
Once a pride of the continent, the Great Lakes Queen, where friends make friends and machines machines. Once a city of the world, now a city in between, with the ice in her air and the winter wind mean. With the ice in her air and the winter wind mean. Here they come flying low over the poplar road. Come away, come away, come away. And those lights ahead, hey, that's Buffalo. Sing, come away, come away, come away. See the glasses raised up o'er Rabbit Road. Come away, come away, come away. And Mary's sister Sue, Denise, Marge, brother Joe, sing, come away, come away, come away. There are families, friends and neighbors. There are lovers and rivals too. At the end of their long day's labors, and their journey's well taken and true. Erie Lake, first light, their ship's fleet of masts. And come away, come away, come away. And all our exiles joined on our homeward decks. Sing, come away, come away, come away. That our families, friends and neighbors, that our lovers and rivals too. At the end of that long day's labors, and their journey's well taken and true. Here they come flying low over the poplar roads. Sing, come away, come away, come away. And those lights ahead, hey, that's Buffalo. Sing, come away, come away, come away.
You're listening to Forging Ahead and experiencing the many facets of the human gem, Sean Cullen. Sean is sharing some stories of over 30 years in acting, theater, film, television, and you just get a sense of the tenacity, the perseverance, the generosity, and the enthusiasm that working actors have for their craft and for their art, and it's just so special. And all of these songs that I'm playing tonight are Sean's. And his voice as well. There's something about the creative spirit that has to channel itself into many different directions. Next up, we've got a piece with talking about working with Carey Mulligan and talking about generosity in actors. And then there's going to be another song. And then a rat-a-tat section where Sean talks about working on the production of The Dead by James Joyce. Bruce Springsteen comes in. Somehow I bring in the Pepsi Challenge. Sean was an understudy to Christopher Walken, The Dead. And the last piece we're going to hear of our conversation is somehow I managed to insinuate myself into Sean's eulogy. Hopefully that won't be for many, many, many years. But continue now with Sean Cullen interview working with Carey Mulligan on She Said.
It my scenes with Carey Mulligan in this movie, she said, both of the scenes that I'm in the movie are with her. And she's so fun. She's so nice. I knocked on her trailer door and because she said, my bad English accents, unpracticed anyway, accents. And she said, she said, they were giving her a phone because I'm on the phone with her. And she was literally talking to me from her trailer while I'm doing take after take on a Madison Avenue. She's on the phone with me. Like, she wanted to do that, which was so cool, right? She didn't have to do that. They could have had, the director or the script supervisor, you name it. One of the PAs could have done it, you know? But she was so cool. Mm. And she would laugh, and we would laugh about things. And then I said, I'm not going to talk to you right now because I really don't have anything to say. It's funny. And she laughed, and then we wouldn't talk. And then we'd say, okay, rolling. And I'd say, okay, Kara, we're going to start again. And she would feed me my lines on the freaking phone. Oh, can you believe it? From her trailer, two avenues away. So nice. So I went to her trailer and knocked on her door, and I ended up sending her a book, this really wonderful novel called Longing by, forget who, but it's about Robert Schumann and his wife, Clara, who was a concert pianist in their relationship. And her husband is with the Mumfreys or a band out of England that's a big deal. Mumford and Sons. Yes, exactly.
Oh, Mumford and Sons.
That's her husband, the lead singer. And I thought, maybe one of the principals in the band. And I think it's the lead singer. And so I thought, I love this book and she's so great. And by the way, they gave it to me at the Rhinebeck Library when Clara was three. I was she was playing with blocks and I started reading this and they said, oh, it's just a dollar. And because it was on the dollar rack, and it's just a great book. And I ended up sending it to her. But anyway, so then I went to the trailer, and I said, this has been so much fun. I said, you've just been great. And she said, yes. And I'm sure she gets it all the time, but she was so warm. There's pictures online of her, she and I, in Bryant Park, doing our first scene in the paparazzi took. And the shots of her, you can see mostly her because they don't want pictures. They're happy to take my back as long as they get her face. And she's having, you should see Kevin, she's having a lovely time. It's just, you want to think that you can be engaging with people and that they enjoy your company. And that's a pretty good indication of one afternoon in New York.
That we do oppose, I'd fly across the world, declare it's you I chose. Unmask the show of friendship as a lover's pose and sing out, ooh, baby, 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 ooh. But when the feelings of your father must now be addressed, 'cause you're his only daughter and he knows what's best. It puts to test your longing for that wedding dress. You worry, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh. So let's take two steps back, take a look what we've got, so we can see who we are and who we are not. Ending to the song for you and used up all the words I know cause none of them were true. I gave up on the sky because it wouldn't stay blue. Made you the apple of my eye, but tell me who says that who? No, there's only one phrase that in your case will do. I love you, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh. Ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh. So let's take two steps back, take a look what we got, so we can see who we are and who we are not.
That was Ooh Baby, Ooh Baby by Sean Cullen. Previously, if you're interested in the music, which why wouldn't you be, was Sister Clover and Suey Appletree. And the second one was Come Away, Come Away, which just a gorgeous, gorgeous song. And what a lovely voice. Next up, like I said, rat-a-tat-tat conversation, which moves from James Joyce, The Dead, to Bruce Springsteen, to the Pepsi Challenge.
The 2.5 years with The Dead and then my 2.5 years with South Pacific were like, that's how we live in our house right now, by the way. The 2.5 years I spent in South Pacific at Lincoln Center. But I will say that I read The Dead when I got I read the story right away. I bought went to the bookstore, and in the city there that afternoon, and I read The Dead, and I was like, oh, okay, oh, and then and the musical, everything I described right that night, and then I continued to feel seeing the show a dozen times over the course of the next 4 weeks, because that's your job, you know, you have to be familiar with the show. Yeah, you have to like know the show, and plus I was covering two people. But When I read The Dead, I was like, oh, wow, okay. And wow, the show, it's like, are you sure this music isn't, like, some of it has to be traditional. They must have, like, written some new songs, but that's a feel, because it's so of the period and the whole thing. But then when I read Dubliners from page one to the end, it's The Dead rang and told like just the most gorgeous bell, in a way that it didn't, affect me, bells, I should say, in a way that it didn't affect me when I read, who knows, maybe The Dead, if I'd read just the story, like the next day, it would have hit me the same way. But the effect of reading cumulatively was a thing, was real, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's art, right? Isn't that what you want? I mean, it's too
to talk about music too. I think maybe the order of the stories in that sense. And I can say this, the Dubliners is very accessible. I mean, you have to plug yourself into your reading a period thing. You know, you're reading a Chekhov sort of story, whatever you're reading. I don't know, Maupassant or I don't know. But you have to, I've never read any. So Guy de Maupassant, but it's super accessible. I just say that for any of the 14 and 50 year old people who put their phones down.
Yeah. No, not the ones I work with. Enticement.
Can I say one more thing about this?
Of course.
Because it's on the order of the stories. I mentioned that, right? The orders of the order of the stories, and I think this is true of storytelling generally. The chronology of something is important. And I've been thinking. I was thinking too about records. I'm too big. I was so pissed off at him. How dare he? On the one hand, with this ticket thing, Springsteen. My college in 1978, St. Bonaventure, and it changed and made my life and ruined my life, like in the same, you know, singing Badlands on out to the Hudson River in Riverside Park the night that I bought my TV and Frank Rich brought the Bills back from like a 40-point deficit against Houston. And I celebrated by bringing my Walkman, my yellow Walkman down to, and I was about that. Well, man, want to be rich. Rich man, want to be king. You know, the whole deal. I love that guy. Right. And he, and probably a lot, Dylan probably too, but he has in his career been very careful about the way he's presenting the songs in terms of order and whatnot. Bring it back to music.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, and again, the world we live in now, the order is whatever order that you want as the consumer to take it, and not necessarily what the artist intended, you know. So you're actually just getting like, if you know, all dessert or all, you know, or all salad, you know, or all whatever you like, you know, and you can get more of that. And you're never forced to sort of experience an album where on a first listen through, you might enjoy, you might, oh, I really love this song. And then I'm not crazy about the next song, but then this third or fourth song, I'll sit through these other songs to get to this one rather than get up and sort of move the needle on the record. But then after four or five listens, you're like, oh, you know what? That song I didn't care for right away, I actually like the most now, right? I just didn't get it, or I needed to warm up to it the first time. Nobody has a chance to do that anymore. And it's like I liken it to the Pepsi challenge.
Say more about that.
Oh, yeah, I know.
please insist and say more about the Pepsi. Don't leave people short.
So the Pepsi challenge is like they give you, there's a Coke and a Pepsi, right? And then the people, you remember that in the Pepsi challenge? And people
yes,
would take a sip of, take a sip of Pepsi, take a sip of Coke.
No, I'm too young. I don't have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, back in the day, there used to be this thing called the Pepsi challenge, Sean. and people like overwhelmingly chose Pepsi, right?
Really? But, oh, well, it was a Pepsi ad.
Well, of course it's a Pepsi ad, but they overwhelmingly chose Pepsi. But the reason people chose Pepsi overwhelmingly, but more people drink Coke by a tremendous margin, is that when you're first tasting something, right, your impression of it is very limited. So the sweetness of the Pepsi, which is sweeter than Coke, lights up people. And they're like, ooh, I like this. But in terms of something that people want to drink a whole can of, less sweet is actually preferred. But that first impression is always going to be for the sparkly, shiny, sweet thing, right? And
keep going.
And that's how we consume everything now.
Yes. Right? I want to give a shout out to Bruce, who I really – I hope he's not mad at me still, because I said some things on Facebook that I regret. But anyway, about the ticket thing and greed, etc. But especially given his MO for the last 50 years. But I want to give a shout out to his album Western Stars. If you ever listened to it,
I have not.
Oh, it's the way it's put together, it's almost like a musical theater piece. It's the first. I think the first song is called Hitchhiking, and it's just give it like three or four listens, and there's some really, you know, catchy songs, but it's the craftsmanship is so good and the order of it, etc. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I want to say, I'm talking to you now, I got my laptop here, and I remember the first time I heard it all the way through, I put the laptop as if it were, you know, like a tin foil hat from, you know, back in the day. I put because I wanted to be quiet so I didn't wake my wife or my daughter. And I literally, not headphones, but with the speakers on the laptop, I put it. I was on the couch laying down and I listened to the whole thing like that quietly. And it was just like, I'll never forget the experience of that.
You said the first night that you loved the new moon, and in all the years since, and all those old moons, you never missed one. At first we would laugh it was easy to do. And like everything else we wished with our love, somehow it came true. Oh, we love the new moon, just a couple of kids. Like everything else we wished with our love to come true, somehow it did. Sometimes it got hard, you in L.A. away, and the baby and me 6 hours in the air, 'cause we had to be beneath the same moon, breathing in the same air. And in spite of the clouds that shrouded the town, what did we care? Oh, we love the new moon and all that it meant. Every month we renewed our love in a lunar sacrament. When we knew her child, the moon would follow you home. Now, darling, I am your moon, and I'm home all alone. So then when will this phase, if that's all that this is? Like the moon, like you say, return what was to what is. Oh, we love the new moon and all that it meant. Every month we renewed our love in a lunar sacrament.
One more pitch for coming to the Hootenanny, even with just your voice, which is quite fine, and we'll be hearing a good bit in the show from your singing. Our bass player is a Joyce scholar.
Oh, I'll tell him how my girlfriend at the time and I ended up on Usher's Island, which is a block on the Liffey. Used to be like an island in the middle of the Liffey, presumably. Mm-hmm. And there, Kevin, if you go to Dublin and Usher's Island, is between the block of A and B, is the house that the dead took place in. And they were going to tear it down. And there was an Irish barrister who came to see us do the dead. He put two bricks in his bag. This was before 9/11, both of which were from homes that had been demolished that Joyce had lived in. And for some reason, when he came to the State Department and flew to Washington that day from Dublin, he put the bricks in his bag, and he left one at the State Department, and the other he presented the night after we met him at the bar at the Watergate on stage to the cast of James Joyce's The Dead, this brick from a house that, right? So I'm hearing all this. And because wow. I do that movie in Bulgaria and all this other stuff that happened because I went out to L.A. to understudy my friend Tim, God bless him, I was in Dublin. And I this was pre-internet, and I went, where's Usher's Island? I'm looking at the street map of Dublin, you know, in the book. And the house, lo and behold, he had bought the house, the barrister, and he was saving it from the wrecker's ball. There was plywood, painted wow. brown plywood in between the sidewalk and the house, you know, to keep the people out in the construction, you know, a mystery to everybody. There were poles in the thing. In the first, and then it was painted with footsteps across the brown, white footsteps. Lily, the caretaker's daughter, was swept off her feet, which is, I believe, the first lines of Joyce's story, unless I've just completely made that up, in The Dead. And there I was in Dublin. enjoy. I felt like I had just like found the holy grail. And none of this.